Fala galera, bem-vindos a mais um episódio do podcast Universo Generalista. Meu nome é Caio Rux Pirandelli e se é a sua primeira vez por aqui, esse é um canal de divulgação científica onde trazemos especialistas e pesquisadores de diversas áreas com o propósito de inspirar e avançar com debates interdisciplinares. E esse é o primeiro episódio do podcast com uma entrevista em inglês. Eu conversei com a Alice Evans sobre relações de gênero em sociedades humanas e por que elas diferem tanto entre si. Essa entrevista conta com legendas nas plataformas de vídeo, como YouTube e Spotify, e eu estou subindo a narração da transcrição em português como episódio extra nas plataformas de áudio. O episódio vai constar com um B na numeração, então esse vai ser o episódio 107B. Um agradecimento à Marina de Amorim Cicliano, que deu uma baita força na sincronização das legendas e fez a maior parte da narração. E um agradecimento especial à apoiadora do canal, Ana Paula Oshida, que fez a revisão das legendas e da tradução delas. E vale lembrar que esse canal segue sendo financeiramente insustentável. Ele corre o risco de ser descontinuado em breve. Então, se você gostaria de ver esse projeto continuar e crescer, não deixe de contribuir mensalmente entrando no nosso Apoia-se ou contribuindo com qualquer valor através da chave Pix de e-mail universogeneralista@gmail.com. Bem, a doutora Alice Evans é professora sênior em Ciências Sociais do Desenvolvimento no King's College London e professora visitante na Universidade de Toronto. Ela está escrevendo um livro chamado A Grande Divergência de Gênero, Por que todas as sociedades se tornaram mais iguais em gênero e por que algumas são mais iguais do que outras. Ela já publicou artigos sobre gênero, urbanização, os impulsionadores de mudanças sociais, desigualdade e redes globais de produção. Além do seu blog Substack, ela tem um podcast que se chama Rocking Our Priors, que eu traduzo como Sacudindo Nossos Pressupostos, onde ela compartilha seus últimos estudos e atualiza suas hipóteses sobre as variáveis que modam as relações de gênero em sociedades humanas. É isso, pessoal. Fiquem agora com a minha conversa com a Alice Evans sobre relações de gênero em sociedades humanas. Hello there, Dr. Alice Evans. First of all, thank you for accepting my invitation, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Alice, I would like to hear from you about your journey. How did you become interested in gender inequalities? How that came to be?
Thank you so much. So I have been researching gender for 14 years now. And then 4 years ago, I realized something that really shook me. So many scholars have looked at what they call the Great Divergence. That is, how did the West become rich and democratic? Why are some countries wealthy while others are much poorer? What explains that international heterogeneity and change over time? And then I realized we can ask the exact same question about gender. Why is there so much global diversity in gender relations? So in the Middle East, South Asia, and North Africa, it is men who go out of their homes to provide for their families and make the laws of the land. Latin America, meanwhile, has seen radical transformation. So you have once Catholic, conservative countries, but now you see rising female labour force participation, soaring female representation, massive feminist rallies, overturning bans on abortion, stronger laws on reproductive rights and against domestic violence. And it's even converging with Europe in terms of gender equality. And so that's so fascinating. I mean, today, Scandinavia and Europe are still some of the most gender equal places in the world. But actually, for most of human history, Europe was far more patriarchal than matrilineal Southeast Asia, the Gulf of Guinea, and even the Andes. So this is what I call the Great Gender Divergence. And I think it is one of the biggest facts about humanity that existing science cannot explain. And so what I'm trying to do now is a totally mental and ridiculous task. I'm trying to answer that question. Like, why is there this cultural diversity? So what I'm trying to do is study the history of every single country in the world and then building up a sort of narrative about what drives change over time, why countries differ, and to sort of build the first ever global history of gender. Now, that is the ambition. Whether I actually achieve it, probably no. But that's the goal.
Nice, nice. And I follow your podcast, and one thing that got my attention was the name of it. Like, you named it Rocking Our Priors.
And I would like to know from you, why did you choose this name?
Right, so I don't think it's a terrible thing if I was wrong in the past. Like, a lot of people have ego. You know, if they said something one, you know, a year ago, they're like, oh, no, I was right. But I don't mind being wrong. In fact, if I was wrong in the past and I now realize something differently, that's because I've seen new information and I've revised my beliefs. And for me, the greatest gift someone could ever give me is showing me that I was wrong in the past, giving me new information that helps me better understand our world. And actually, this is something that everyone, myself included, will struggle with. You know, we all have our confirmation bias, and that means we're predisposed to pay more attention to information that fits with our pre-established beliefs. So if I'm racist, for example, I will look for information that, you know, proves those assumptions and disregard disconfirm any evidence. So even if there's one black person who's incredibly brilliant, I might say, that's just one guy, whatever. So these confirmation bias, whether it's gender, whether it's race, or whether it's just our theories about economic growth, that can bias our understanding. So what I really try to do is, well, let me unpack and explore all the different evidence. So let me give another example. Feminists may be very opposed to ideas that there are biological differences between men and women. And so they may just ignore all that evidence on neuroscience, for example. You know, they don't like that explanation because it could mean that, you know, if there are biological differences, then therefore patriarchy is inevitable and we should just accept it. And so their priors, their ideology may blind them from understanding the way that biology could interact with culture. But I try, to the best of my ability, not to be blinded by these prayers and to think, okay, let me rock them.
Okay. And did you get this from, like, did you learn this from someone, or is it just part of your personality? Because it's quite unusual, to be honest. Like, even in science, we're supposed to do this, like, as a way to do science, right? But it's just part of your personality, or you learned this somewhere or from someone?
So perhaps my first degree was in philosophy. And when I studied philosophy, you know, I learned really crazy things. Like, maybe I'm just a brain in a vat. Maybe the external world is pretend. You know, once you've got into that mentality of thinking, oh, maybe the external world doesn't even exist, then you're ready to embrace really crazy ideas. So I was like, okay, let me just go with it, right? Once you've really immersed yourself in all that craziness. But for me, ultimately, the most important thing is to try to not have ego and just to be excited about learning and improving my understanding of the world. And I think that as long as I'm upfront and honest and say that I'm learning and encourage people to criticize me, then it's not bad if people say, hey, Alice, you're wrong. You know, I think the important thing is the mentality, right? Not to be so consumed by my own ego or by my own pride that it upsets me if someone tells me I'm wrong. If I say, hey, I want to listen, I want to learn from you, then that sort of changes the conversation. That it means that when someone gives me that new information, I receive it as a present rather than as an insult.
Okay. Interesting. It's I think it's the best approach to science and to get to the truth, our closest possible to the truth, right? And how do you feel about, like, I believe you get attacked from both sides, right?
Yes, this is perfectly true. Say that? Perfectly true. There are lots of people who will dislike what I do. Many.
And how do you feel about this? Like, are you able to also filter this out and not get affected by it? Because every time I read your blog post, there is always someone there to attack you, but not based on what you wrote, but just based on, like, they feel attacked because you're actually questioning things that they believe in. So how do you manage that?
I think that it's perfectly normal that people have a range of opinions and beliefs, and some people will be triggered by things and sensitive about things and not think. And I think we just have to accept this, right? And I think, in fact, I mean, if you look at big books about the world, like I mentioned earlier, all those big books about why is the West more wealthier and more democratic, those big books are often written by men. And that correlates with men are much more likely to be confident. So, for example, there's a new survey that came out showing that, you know, men are much more likely to say that they could safely land a plane. Like, could you land this plane? And like the average American guy would say, yeah, sure, I could land a plane. Whereas women would be like, no way could I land a plane, right? And so that's a gender difference in confidence. I don't know whether it's biology or whether it's socialization. But if one is very neurotic, if one is constantly worried about how other people will perceive you, if one is so sensitive to the possibility of attack, then one can self-censor and stay totally quiet. And I think that's part of the reason why fewer of these big books are published by women. Like you have men may be overconfident, think, yeah, I can have a big theory about the world, no problem, right? Whereas women will be like, okay, I want to understand this very specific, narrow phenomenon. I want to get it right. And so our fears and our anxiety about social critique can actually encourage people to stay quiet. And I think that is possibly harmful. So for me, I take the view, well, let me try to understand it as best I can. And I'm a little bit insecure, I confess. And I think that works to my benefit because I'll read as much as possible before writing something down. You know, there's a sort of Goldilocks level of confidence, right? If you're super, super arrogant, then you'll just write stuff down without investigating it. If you're very, very nervous and shy, then maybe you don't write anything down at all because you're worried about the critique. But if you're the Goldilocks level of confidence, then you investigate a lot, write something down and say and express it in the sort of mode of encouraging critique. And hey, maybe you can sort of get along with it.
Nice. And Alice, going to like into the gender inequalities, right?
Yes.
Let's go into that. And can you give us a brief definition of matriarchy and patriarchy just so we can start?
Absolutely. So I would see a patriarchal society as one where men dominate positions of prestige. So that could be in business, in government, in religion. And also that men are culturally revered, that they're seen as deserving of deference, they're recognized as respected authorities. So that could be the presumption that men are entitled to beat their wives, or men should be served dinner, you know, they should be sitting at home while others wait on them, and they are the knowledgeable authorities. For example, in America, there's a survey of newspapers over the past 100 years, and they find that newspapers typically depict men as more intelligent. They typically depict men as geniuses. The word genius is never associated with women. So it's both dominance of political and economic positions, but also how people see men and women, how men and women treat each other. And so though that definition of patriarchy, I would just flip that for a matriarchy. So a matriarchy would be a society in which all the big positions dominated by women, and also women are culturally revered. So if I may give a spoiler to the Barbie film, the new Barbie film, it's initially set in a matriarchy. Barbie Land is a matriarchy in that the Madame President is female, with all the Barbie dream houses are owned by women, the Constitution is written by women, the Supreme Court is by women, and there are all these celebrations of female brilliance. So all their big prizes are won by women. Everyone thinks women are fantastic, and in that society, women are very assured and they're very assertive. So they don't have anxiety, they don't doubt themselves. When men are rude or dismissive or pester them, they just say, no, I don't have time for this. So it's the whole cultural system. So Barbie Land is a matriarchy.
And can we say actually that there's also a spectrum, right?
Yes, yes.
Because it's like fully matriarchal or patriarchal. It's not always the case, right? It's not like 100%. How do you manage this kind of like spectrum? And how can you judge too? Like how can you judge if something's actually a patriarchy or not?
Absolutely. So I think it's really important to pay attention to as many different indicators and as variables as possible. So there are a couple of global gender indices which are like composite. So they would include female labor force participation, female representation in parliament, gender gaps in education, and gender in health. Most Latin American countries score, if we think in a global perspective, they're usually in the sort of upper third. They're in the third most gender equal countries in the world, because female labor force participation has come right up. You know, it's around between 50 and 60%. So it's got a lot higher in most Latin American countries, but not in Brazil. Female representation has got much higher. In Brazil, it's only 18%. In other Latin American countries, it's more like 45%, 40%. And also women have mobility. They move freely in the streets. They're out and about. So compare that to when I travel through India, I can go through a street and not see any women, for example. In India, the 88% of their parliamentarians are men. Female victims of domestic violence will rarely report that they've been beaten. One, because they're so stigmatized, they're so ashamed, they don't anticipate that the police will do anything about it. And moreover, female labor force participation is so low that they are now dependent on their patriarchal guardians. So Latin America is very different in that because women are increasingly working, they're much more economically independent. Because you've had these massive rallies against gender-based violence, like Niu No Menos, you know, huge protests that stigma has been reduced. I mean, Latin America has some of the biggest feminist protests in the world. Like 8th of March is absolutely massive in Argentina, in Mexico, etc. So we can see across the world and over time, Latin America has changed, right? But women may still experience sexual harassment, assault. Women may still face very high risk of femicide. So it's not absolutely gender equal, but if we compare it to Egypt, if we compare it to Iran, if we compare it to India, then it's more gender equal. So going back to your question, I need to be thinking about all these different variables, like the perceptions of sexual harassment, whether people see women as leaders, whether women are discriminated against at work, the kind of penalties for having a kid, et cetera, et cetera. So one needs to take a very holistic view.
Okay. And going to the, like, to the core of it, right, to the core of how societies are formed and how they actually come about, like, do cultures actively choose to be matriarchal or patriarchal?
That's a good question. I don't think it's that people really make a choice. Like, I'm going to sit there, hey, shall I be a patriarch today or not? Right? Mm-hmm. But we do see patriarchy arising as a result of certain conditions. So if we go back 100,000 years, back in the time when humans were hunter-gatherers, women could still be beaten, they could still be abused, they might still be raped, they could still be married polygamously, at least as we know from contemporary hunter-gatherers. So it wasn't a feminist utopia, but there's no evidence at the moment that women were secluded, like they weren't kept inside their homes. They were really vital to the forager economy. They went out to gather herbs, gather fruits, etc. Then there seems to be a big step change, not with the Neolithic Revolution, but a little bit later, when you have the plough, when you have irrigation, when you have domesticated crops, domesticated herds, then people have inherited wealth. So that inherited wealth was very insecure because other men might come to want your stuff, right? So what did men do? They tended to gather as patrilocal clans to protect their stuff, right? So you want strength in your brothers, your uncles, your cousins. So when we see the rise of the plough, where we see domesticated herds, those groups tend to be patrilocal. Then another big step change occurred with military technologies. So there were some groups that were especially patriarchal. So for example, the Yamnaya that came from the steppe, that came from the Eurasian steppe. Certain groups in the Middle East seemed to be especially patriarchal. And when they had improved military technologies, that is the horse and chariots, the chariots that were developed around 4,000 years ago, they conquered other groups and institutionalized patriarchal dominance. So when a group of patriarchs captures a city, then they can impose their rule of law. And then those patriarchal authorities can amass more power and wealth because their armies enable them to conquer new land. They're amassing all those resources and they can institutionalize patriarchy. And because they're the elites, then everyone might look up to them and want to be like them. So how do you act like the elites? Oh, well, you also become much more patriarchal. So, for example, you start secluding women. We have also the Axial Age. So this is the birth of religions, specifically moralizing supernatural punishment. And many of those Abrahamic, Christian, Hindu religions, they tended to have this idea that women should stay at home, that women should be secluded, and really importantly, that men's honor depends on protecting women's chastity. And so in those societies, women tended to retreat to the private sphere. So religion and culture seem to reinforce these things. But all this is shaped by geography. So in cultures where mountains or oceans or parasites stop some of those changes, then you don't see the emergence of female seclusion. So, for example, many of those Yamnaya pastoralists, they never made it to the Americas because of the massive Atlantic Ocean, right? So those patriarchal conquests didn't happen in Latin America. So in the pre-colonial period, native indigenous people, none of them had this idea of female seclusion. That just didn't come here. And I think one of that is the fact that these patriarchal people didn't conquer. But also importantly, the biggest animal was the llama. So that llama makes it harder to accumulate wealth. Because you can't transport that wealth. So it's much, much harder to accumulate wealth through the llama. So elsewhere, trade would have led to some big rich men becoming super, super rich through trade, where it's harder. Whereas for example, in the Andean region, Ailu communities, they tended to be much more egalitarian. They had communal wealth. And so women weren't secluded. In fact, women were very vital to what they call minga labor, which is like reciprocal labor. North America and also in Brazil, another factor is that groups can move around. And so they really valued female labor. Many of these groups were matrilineal, tracing descent through the female line. Now, none of that means that women were necessarily autonomous or necessarily free. Like, for example, the Inca would go around different villages and take girls aged between 11 and 14 to be like virgins, to be sacrificed or to be given to provincial headmen. But the point is that in indigenous American women were never secluded. And this is the really, really important thing, female seclusion. Because it's female seclusion that shapes whether women in the 20th century go out to work or not. So around the world, there's a big difference in whether cultures prioritize female seclusion. So in some societies like the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, and historically in East Asia, men's honor depended on female chastity. And that's a result of the forces I mentioned earlier. And so as the 20th century enables job-creating economic growth, in those societies, even if people see job opportunities, because men's honor is so dependent on women remaining at home and women's chastity remaining secure, they may say, hey, it's just not worth it. It's really important for me to be seen as honorable, to be seen as respected. So I don't want anyone to start gossiping about us. So therefore, women won't go out to work. So in those societies, you need a massive level of job-creating economic growth for female employment to rise, because the available income has to be sufficiently high to compensate for men's loss of honor. And that's what happened in East Asia. The factories opened all over. Lots of factory recruiters came to the villages. And fathers were like, hey, I care about my honor, my face, but it was worth it. The income returns were so good. Now, in Latin America, it's slightly different. Because the indigenous people did not have such a strong preference for honor. And also because many of the European migrants did not have this strong, strong conception of female seclusion, then you need less job creating economic growth for women to go out and work, right? And in fact, in Latin America, we've seen that female employment is often anti-cyclical. That is, when business is really bad, women go to work because they're desperate for family survival, and more families increasingly rely on female labor force participation. So in Latin America, women really flock to economic opportunities. So when female, with increased female education, with increased, with falling fertility, and also a really big fact, a really big and under-recognized fact about Latin America is that Latin America has a very high percentage of people living in cities relative to its level of development. So if you look across the world, in poorer countries, people tend to be much more rural. Latin America is actually heavily, heavily urban. It's just as urban as many European countries. And this makes a big difference for several things. One is it enables social norms to change much more quickly. If you're gathering in cities and towns, you're connected by radio, you read newspapers, you see alternatives, you see strikes, you see protests. And you might see a woman dressed going to an office. You might see a street mural celebrating women. You see some woman building her own house. And all that heterogeneity, all that diversity makes you rethink your beliefs, whether it's about women or about the church. So cities really catalyze social change. It can make people reject their traditional beliefs and become much more open and liberal and secular. And that's a very important part of Latin America's story. It's not just that women need to work, but also Latin Americans have overwhelmed, especially more middle class people, have become much more secular. And I think cities are an important part of that process, that people see and hear different ideas. And so Latin Americans really increasingly embrace liberalism. And that's important for female employment. So I was recently in Mexico for a month, and I interviewed Mexican men and women in six different towns, and many of them told me that people used to gossip a lot, and people would be very sensitive to that gossip. So if people were saying, hey, that's a woman with young children, she should really be at home, or hey, that woman shouldn't be doing this, you know, they might even bully a woman. So a group of women may go around and speak negatively about the woman who they pass, or say, that's no good, you know, that's not respectable. Or people would even say, what will people think, you know, I don't want to do this because what will people think? And so if people anticipate social disapproval and really care about that disapproval, then maybe the man doesn't want his wife to work, or the woman herself doesn't want to work because they worry about all this social censorship. But I think over the past 50, 20 years, in much of Latin America, and especially in cities, people have become much more individualistic. So they're less concerned about social judgment and disapproval. They're much more focused on, okay, let me make sure I have economic security. Let me make sure I can provide for my children. And for that, we need two earners. Like, I'm not going, you know, whatever, you know, even if someone down the road thinks this isn't good, whatever, they're not, you know, people in Mexico would say, you know, even if I'm judged by some woman down the road, she's not going to help me. Right? She's not going to pay for my children's education. She's not going to feed me tomorrow. So let me focus on doing my thing. Let me get ahead and whatever. So I think this process, sorry, that was a very long answer to your original question. But I think this is part of the process of how cities and some economic opportunities in conjunction with falling fertility and rising female education means that we now see this change over time.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to take a step back.
And yes, of course, sorry.
And summarize some of the things you said. Yes. That is not, like, for the public, like, to the audience that is actually listening. Might be the first time, like, listening to you and hearing about all these variables.
Yes.
Coming into play to actually shape gender relations, right? Yes. I think the first thing is just geography, right?
Yes.
So geography plays a part in terms of, like, because you have a limited set of options based on the geography, right? It could be like a subsistence. It depends on geography. So you can, like, if there's no lakes or oceans around you, you're not going to fish, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah, absolutely. I want to add another fun point about geography.
Okay.
So there's some nice research by Martin Fisbein, who's Argentinian, and he has a new paper out looking at how crop type affects human cooperation. So in America, in parts of America where the only crop you could grow required lots and lots of labor, people had to cooperate more. And in those societies and in those communities, they tended to give their children common names. Like, they wanted to conform. They didn't want to stand out from the crowd. And even today, people are more likely to be much more communal, to favor team sports. So likewise in China. So in China, in East Asia, people grow rice. And that is very, very heavily labor intensive. And Thomas Talhelm, an economist, theorizes that that gave rise to East Asia's collectivist culture, because people needed to cooperate in building irrigation, in transplanting seedlings. That made them a much more culturally tight society. And now there's a Latin American example, I theorize at least, I speculate. So growing potatoes in the Andes was very, very labor intensive, because what they do, and it's very special to the Andes, is not only do they grow the potatoes, but then they leave them out at night to freeze them. And then in the day, they will dry in the sun. And this process takes 5 days. So it's a very labor intensive process, and it's very special to the Andes. You're only able to do this because it's very cold and then very hot. Right? And this was a very important, because by freeze drying the potatoes, they last much longer, because otherwise they would just rot. So the potatoes were super, super important. It enabled them to transport and feed soldiers, for example, in the Inca Empire. Right. We also know that Andean women, there's also very nice evidence from 1,000 years ago looking at skeletons across what is now Peru. And they find that in the highland areas, the bones show much more wear and tear, which suggests that people were working very, very hard. Whereas in the coastal lowland areas, their skeletons have much less wear and tear. And today in Peru, in the highland areas, rural and urban women work at very, very high rates. It's like 90% of women are in the labor force. And and they also have this very strong conception, as of what I was saying earlier, of Minga reciprocal labor, that people help each other in their community. And Peruvians also have these very strong ideas of conformity and ideas of kinship and ideas of collectivism, and also socially policing their group. So I think the Andean potato is a nice example of how a crop, when you happen to live on a mountain, that the crop you grow for your comparative and for your absolute advantage is very labor intensive, that encourages all these reciprocal labor institutions, which in turn give rise to a culture of interdependence and collectivism and cooperation, with far less support for someone being individualistic. You know, you can only maintain those reciprocal labor institutions if you say no to someone who wants to be totally weird and crazy and wacky and do their own thing. You need to punish, you know, dissent, etc. So absolutely. So whereas wheat, for example, does not require much labor, it does not require much interdependence. So wheat-growing cultures tend to be much more individualistic. So Italians, for example, going back, and Greeks, for example, they grew wheat, and that culture would have been much more individualistic. So yeah, there's a lot. So geography can shape culture. It's not the only thing. You know, even among wheat-grown cultures, we see a lot of heterogeneity, right? You know, Egyptians are very different from Italians today. And that, you know, we need to trace the whole history of that. Anyway, so that was another example of geography. Sorry, you must interrupt me, because I will just go down any tangent.
Okay, I'll do that.
Alice with her rabbit holes, right? I'll just go down my rabbit hole, and you've got to get me out.
Okay, and then we have like pastoralism, right?
Yes,
which is something...
Yes.
Is there like when you compare hunter gatherers, pastoralism, horticulture, and agriculture, do we see a pattern that actually, I don't know, tends to be more patriarchal on this?
This is a great question. Okay, so
because you narrow down the options, right?
Pastoral, I'm so glad you brought up pastoralism. So this is an example of an inherited asset that you'd want to pass down the male line, and you need a strong group of men to protect and safeguard. And pastoralists tend to have a strong culture of honor. They tend to glorify violence because men need to act tough and macho so no one dares to steal their stuff. So there's a nice paper by Cao et al. And they find that pastoralists, they tend to have this culture of honor. They tend to valorize violence. But actually, around the world and over time, there's a lot of diversity in pastoral culture. So, for example, the Mongols and the ancient Turkic group from Central Asia, they recognized women as authorities. So the ancient Ogon inscriptions said the Khan and the Khatun decree, like the king and the queen both say this. And the Mongols, that is in the Eurasian steppe, little girls were growing up on horses, and actually horses may have reduced men's biological advantage, because even if men have more endurance, they're stronger, they're tougher, on a horse, a woman can be fast, and a woman could be very proficient in archery. So Mongols and ancient Turkic groups use what they call the recursive bow, and this is very light, and you could do very nice acrobatics like stand upside down on a horse and all sorts of things like that. And women were very good at this recursive bow because it was very light, it didn't require big manly upper body strength. And so they found lots of graves whereby it's women warriors, you know, young women with loads and loads of weaponry. So the idea is that women could be just as good. And there's an area in Anatolia, in northern Turkey, the Amazons. And, you know, Herodotus wrote about them. There's lots of evidence that the Amazons actually existed. There was this group of women who were fighters on horseback. You know, they not only had the horse, but they could train a falcon or train a hawk or train a dog to come with them hunting. So that's one example of pastoralists whereby women may have status. Even, like, for example, Nigeria today is very patriarchal, especially northern Nigeria, which was under the Sokoto Caliphate, which has very strict Islamic ideas where women are kept at home. Female labor force participation is very, very low. Women are, you know, not supposed to speak in public forum, etc., and they're all veiled. But actually, in the 16th century, those exact same ethnic group, the Hausa, was led by Queen Aminana. So that is a military army was led by a queen. So even in the exact same geography, we can see huge cultural variation. Or today in, so Egypt and Somalia today are, well, upper Egypt is sort of pastoral because it's very dry. That at that point of the Nile, it's quite narrow. It can't sustain many crops. So people are pastoralists. Now today, that whole region is very patriarchal, right? Somalia, extremely patriarchal. But going back 3,000, 4,000 years ago to the kingdom of Nubia, there were lots of female queens. Women moved freely. So there's lots of evidence that even in the exact same geography, we can see enormous cultural evolution. So geography and crops may be part of the story, but they're not deterministic. So this is what makes my job very hard, that I need to trace every single thing from 4,000 years ago to today.
Yeah, the influx of cultures, different cultures can change. Like in Brazil, there's a tendency to think that ideology drives everything, right? Uh-huh. So that's the point. That's why I brought up geography, because that's not, most of the time, it's not taken into account when you talk about these the formation of societies and cultures, right? But then you have also, like, it's not deterministic. Like, so you have geography, and then you have cultural practices that vary, even in Brazil. Like you have Amerindian cultures that are like share pretty much the same geography, and they have very different traditions. But of course, it narrows down the possibilities, right? Like, and also there's competition between cultures too, right? Which is like depending on the strategy to make a living, then expansion is kind of forced down to other cultures. So they have to expand, and in order to expand, they have to adapt culturally to survive, right? So there's also this.
Let me give you an example of that.
Yes, please.
Okay, so did you know that maybe in 700 BC in Arabia, there were queens? So the Assyrians wrote about seven queens of the Arabs, and they detailed them in their battles. And so, you know, this is Arabia. So this is, you know, one of the most patriarchal places today, the Arabian Gulf, right? Qatar, Saudi Arabia. There were seven queens all written about. And there are a couple of palace reliefs showing these queens. And what may have happened is that these women led their armies, but then their armies were often butchered, and there was, you know, and when the Assyrians humiliated them, they even include a very horrible relief showing Arab women being murdered and butchered, and even killing a baby in a womb, that maybe the Arabs, you know, had female leaders, but then they saw themselves being butchered by the Assyrians, who are also very, very patriarchal, and thought, okay, no, we don't like this system. It's not working out for us, you know. So yes, absolutely. Things can change. So yes, it could have been through by being humiliated by the Assyrians could have led to a cultural shift. Also, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, the Bantu expansion, which occurred 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, that is Bantus coming out of the Gulf of Guinea and spreading around sub-Saharan Africa. If we look at the genetic data, it looks like they would have attacked other groups. Now, if you're under attack, what might happen is that you form a patrilocal clan to protect yourself against outsiders. So, you know, so all these different dynamics. So exactly, as you say, competition can lead to a shift in kinship systems.
And then is that the case that matriarchal societies are rare?
And I would say today there are zero matriarchal societies. I think it only exists in Barbie land. But there are matrilineal societies, and that's where descent is traced down the female line. Now, matrilineal societies are not necessarily matriarchal. So even if descent is followed down the female line, okay, usually women have more freedom to move around, but often the authority figure is like the uncle rather than the father. So it's not like it's some kind of feminist utopia. Those matrilineal societies are also incredibly vulnerable and very fragile. No matrilineal society has ever got rich. And that's, I think, my theory is because men don't like matrilineal systems. Because, for example, in Bembeland, that is in Zambia, 100 years ago, a man would have to work for his wife's parents. Like, he had zero status. He was a nobody. He had to just plow their fields. Then he didn't own the land. He didn't have ownership or control over his children. He was an outsider. It was nothing. So in every single society, systematically, when you see a rise in wage labor markets or a rise in some other way of getting rich for men, some kind of economic independence, men leave matrilineal systems. So in Zambia, men left the villages and they went to work in the copper belt mines, and then they started their own nuclear families. Like, they did not like matrilineal. Why would you? Why would you want to be like under someone else's system? And so matrilineal systems weaken for two reasons. One, men don't like them. Secondly, men are never constrained. So because the matrilineal inheritance is descended down the female line, they don't police men. So they don't stop men from moving away. You know, they care about the woman and her having children. So men have zero restrictions. So if a man wants to go off to the copper belt, he can. So the man has the economic incentive to leave and no constraints. So he does. As soon as you get a bit of job creating economic growth, he leaves. The same thing does not happen under patrilineal systems. They are much more stable. Why is that? Because patrilineal systems trace descent down the male line. They care enormously about the purity and paternal certainty. So you only know that child is yours if you impose restrictions on the woman, right? Because if the woman is moving about too freely, then who knows she's been having sex with, right? So yes, patrilineal systems tend to have a preference for female chastity. So it's much harder for women to just up and go. There are much more heavier restrictions. Of course, this varies slightly with culture, but for the most part, patrilineal cultures that trace descent down the male line put up obstacles to women going about too freely. So that makes them a bit more durable.
Mm-hmm. In talking about like bringing some kind of gender equality to a society, to a culture, right?
Yes.
How do you do that? Like, what are the paths you've seen that actually works, and what are the ones that actually do not work?
Huh, great question. So I think there are three. Let's say there are three very important drivers. One, job creating economic growth. So East Asia used to be incredibly patriarchal. Women were unfree, they were oppressed, their marriages were arranged. So a woman might be taken from one house, told to marry another, and then secluded and surveilled. So in China, at the turn of the 20th century, many women had their feet broken and bound, and that was to signal their chastity, to show that they weren't going to leave the inner quarters. And if you look at Chinese poetry, women talk about how sad they are, their lack of freedoms, they don't own their own land, they're in someone else's home. So women were terribly, terribly abused. But that changed with job-creating economic growth, with massive manufacturing. As I said, the income compensated for men's loss of honor. So women were allowed to go to the cities where they mixed and mingled and saw alternatives and started dating independently. They also remitted earnings back to their parents, and they demonstrated filial piety. So parents came to favor daughters. So South Korea, for example, there's now a preference for daughters because they're seen as equally valued. And that also interacts with having public pensions. So now that parents in South Korea don't have so much economic insecurity, it's fine to have a daughter. So it's really, really important to have massive job-creating income growth, because that's what drives up female employment. Female employment is instrumentally important because it enables women to gather. It enables women to share ideas. It enables them to bitch and moan and complain about patriarchy, right? So anthropologists will talk about reverse dominance coalitions. That is, women getting together and contesting patriarchal privileges and saying, hey, you know, don't mansplain to me, or don't treat me like I'm an idiot, or don't be so rude, or defending their friends. Or if their friend is abused and maltreated, talking to say, hey, you deserve better. So lots of women may endure abusive or horrific maltreatment, whether it is from their brothers, their fathers, their co-workers, their bosses, or their husbands, because they just don't question it. Or maybe they don't think they can do any better, or because they don't think there's any alternative. But if they get together with other women, if they see ni uno menos, then they may come to reject that ideology of shame and stigma that keeps women silent and afraid, that stops them from demanding accountability. So that is the second mechanism, reverse dominance coalitions. And that can be you and your friend. It's not necessarily a female friend. It can be a male friend. It can be a protest. It can be a street demonstration. It can be social media. So, for example, there's the Azul Mineral. Have you heard the song, the Azul Mineral song, that was in many Latin American protests on the 8th of March?
Yes.
There are these women, and they're like, you know, for however many centuries women have been abused, and we're not going to take it anymore. And I can't remember the lyrics, but right, but it's a very powerful chant, right? And if you look at TikToks of women's marches or protests in Latin America, they often use that the Lau Crespa chant, because it's all about, you know, it's all about creating this sense of solidarity that women have been abused for so long and we're not going to take it anymore. So it's all about building a sense of solidarity, and that's very, very important. So that's the second mechanism. So first, it's high female employment. Second is feminist activism. Not just the big protests, but also little groups of solidarity that could even be two sisters. A third important driver, important mechanism, is state capacity. And this is important for two reasons. In very anarchic situations, like maybe northern Mexico, especially historically, men have to act tough so that other guys don't mess with them. So you have this idea of machismo, right? Men acting tough. And systematically across Latin America, in places where people think that men should be tough, where you should be a vigilante, where a man should enforce law and order, where he should take the law into his own hands and wield a gun, those kind of places tend to endorse wife beating. So you get these very, very macho guys who need to express that toughness. And that that general criminality tends to be associated with more punitive authoritarianism over their wives. And it's important for another reason. So in Latin America, there have been these massive protests, as we were saying, about gender-based violence. But still, the state is often perceived as criminal, as incapable, and as inept. And this means that two things, that women may not report gender-based violence, or the police may not do anything about it. And so male impunity for gender-based violence can continue. So a friend of mine, Carolina Artiga, has just done some nice research in Puerto Rico, and they find that there are these new domestic violence courts for women. But they haven't changed anything because people still think the state is corrupt. They still think the police won't do anything about it. Pulumi Roy Chowdhury over in India has a very nice book called Incapable States, Capable Women. And even if women go to the police, even if they beg for help, the police are so overburdened, they say, hey, just go away, women, go away. So a big problem in Latin America specifically, and also in places like India and sub-Saharan Africa, is even though you have female employment, even though you have massive feminist rallies, if people think the state won't help them, then that male impunity for violence can persist. And let me give them a personal example. So when I was in Oaxaca in Mexico, I was actually attacked. I was punched in the face, a guy grabbed my phone, etc., and I was covered in blood. So I run. Anyway, I call up the police. What do they do? Nothing. Right? Yeah. And so I imagine, and many Mexicans have a similar perception of the police. You know, if you think the police is useless, then you don't go to them for help. But that means that men continue to get away with violence and know that they can continue to get away with violence. So you need those three conditions. High female employment, because it enables the solidarity, the reverse dominance coalitions, and the capable state. Now, if you don't have all three of those conditions, then it doesn't work. For example, China has high female employment and a strong state, but it doesn't have feminist activism. So the state continues to be very, very authoritarian. Tian Zeng has a new book called Violent Intimacy, and she shows that the police totally dismiss women who claim that they've been beaten by their husbands. So the state is incredibly authoritarian. The government, which is almost entirely male, has actually decriminalized domestic violence. So it's perfectly legal to smack your wife about, to really hurt her psychologically and physically. So if you don't have feminist activism, if you don't have that pressure on the state to reform, then it doesn't matter if the state is strong. So it's those three conditions. You need all of them, ideally.
Okay, that's the case for the former communist countries, right? For example, if you take Soviet Union, where you have like employment was used.
Very high,
but then there's no space because it's a
totalitarian
regime.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, there's no way to organize, so feminists couldn't organize their collectives and do the work that was necessary to move forward in terms of gender equality. Is that the case?
Exactly. So communism in Eastern Europe and in China helped promote women's economic advancement. It helped close gender gaps in the economy. But in terms of feminism, that was totally suffocated, totally suppressed. So still today in Eastern Europe, people continue to endorse these misogynist ideas that, you know, a woman who gets raped, she was probably asking for it. You know, what was she doing? Who was she out with? So yes, they tend to be a little bit more sexist, and there's less pressure for more women in parliaments, etc.
Okay. It's common to think about gender equality or acceptance of gender equality when you compare, like you said, when you compare the rural area to cities.
Yes. Right?
So is it possible to be like more, bring equality to rural areas, or is it just depend on many other factors? Because in Brazil, it's kind of a case, you know, it's kind of the case, like where big cities, they're way more, where they accept many more different kind of practices than anything. But when you go to rural area, it tends to, even in the U.S., it's very similar too.
Yes, right? I think for sure.
The right wing, more conservatives, they come from the rural area. So is it possible to bring change to that? Or it depends on this element of having a lot of people around you and so on.
Let me say that it is possible for villages to change to become more gender equal. So, for example, in England, right? People in villages may still be very gender equal. It's not like, right? So it's possible to have very gender equal villages. And I was in small town Alabama. Lots of women were working, respected, fathers playing with their kids. So it's not impossible. It's not impossible. But in places like in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, in the Middle East, North Africa, or in South Asia, we tend to see much stronger knit, close-knit policing. Very strong policing of people, and that feeds into what we were discussing before about the interdependence. So where you rely on other people, you're much more sensitive to the ostracism. So like I was saying before, you asked me, oh, Alice, don't you care about if people say something negative about you? Well, you know, I've got a certain degree of independence, right? Right? Yes. I've got some economic independence. So even if one group dislikes me, it's fine. I've got other friends. So it doesn't matter so much if you have this dislike from one section of society, because I can always find other people who are very nice to me and who will support me, right? That doesn't happen in the village. In the village, there's one group that tends to be more socially dominant, and if they ostracize you, then you're out. So it's not just about whether you're ostracized or not, but what are your exit options? How many other groups are there? So in groups, in villages where people are very economically interdependent, where they rely on each other for mutual insurance, then you need to be very, very concerned if you're ostracized. And moreover, in very poor places, there's much higher economic interdependence. Secondly, in those very poor places, there's less exposure to media alternatives. So whereas in the English village, someone might still have, you know, basic security and be able to watch a lot of diverse media that could help them see things differently. In an Indian village, there may be less of that exposure to international heterogeneity. And even if they did see it, they would still be reluctant to rock the boat. So I think for the most part, it's very, very difficult to stimulate change in villages. And actually, last year, I went to many Indian villages in the state of Bihar, which is in northern India. It's incredibly patriarchal, so women veil, they rarely work. The rate of female labor force participation is about 6%. So it's one of the lowest rates in the world. And I asked women if they knew a woman who had left her village for work, and they always said no. They had just never heard of it. So it's not like Sao Paulo, where you see all that diversity, you see so many different things going on. If you never see a woman leaving the village, if you never hear of it, then you may not even consider it. Moreover, if the one woman who does leave the village suffers a big negative shock, that everyone speaks badly about her, oh, well, I bet she went to Delhi and I bet she did this, oh, and she's probably a very bad woman, then it doesn't have any kind of role model effect, because all people hear are these negative stories. So in these close-knit societies, men depend heavily on their jati, that is their kin, they're concerned to mutual insurance, so no one wants to rock the boat. So it's like a collective action problem, that no one family wants to stick their neck out, because then they'll be ostracized. So everyone conforms, but then no one ever sees anyone rocking the boat, so they all think, oh, well, everyone's going to judge us negatively. And actually, there may be a misperception there. So there's this very nice research in Latin America and worldwide called Misperceived Gender Norms. And they find that people actually tend to underestimate men's support for female employment. And that's going to be much, much higher in villages, because you're never seeing anything different, right? And you're very, very concerned about social approval. So you never see anything different. You really care what other people think. And so you just go with the flow. So you get locked into this homogeneity. You get locked into this negative equilibrium whereby nothing changes. So that's why in cities we see much more rapid social change.
Okay. And one big question, especially in the case of Brazil,
yes,
is what is the the role of language, like Portuguese is a gendered language, right? And there's been some activist groups that have that put pressure on changing the language to something more neutral, or even adding, like, instead of using masculine plurals, using feminine plurals, and so on. Do we have any kind of evidence on the impact of these changes or not?
Okay, so that's a great question. So let's take France. French is a gendered language with masculine and feminine. It's also one of the most gender equal countries in the world. So women earn 44% of the labor share of income. So of all labor income, 44% is earned by women. Women also are almost half of their parliament. So there's a lot of gender equality in France. So clearly, a gendered language is no barrier to relative gender equality. On top of that, I would say, well, let's think about how people actually form their stereotypes about women. Actually, a lot of the evidence suggests it's by observing their communities around them. So if they see men in positions of leadership, if people see others respecting men as knowledgeable authorities while demanding, while expecting women scrubbing and sweeping the floors, then that's what shapes their stereotypes. It's by growing up in your little village or your big city, seeing what other people in your community do, seeing who they respect, how they treat others, that's what shapes our views of women. And it's not just about our gender stereotypes, it's also about our government policies. So for example, in many Latin American countries, the school day is very short because they put the kids back to back. Like they have one set coming in the morning and another set coming in the afternoon. So make use of the scarce school buildings. That creates a massive difficulty for parents, which often pushes women into more informal work, right? Because if your kid is only at school from, say, 8 a.m. till 2 p.m., then how on earth can you get a full-time job? So instead, what you have to do is go for a lesser job, which is usually paying less money. And employers will also have these stereotypes. So the employers will likely think, wow, you know, a woman's going to be a bit useless because she might have a kid, and then what's she going to do at 2 p.m.? So that's a government policy which is actually penalizing parents, and let's be honest, that burden usually falls on mothers. So that's a government policy which has a much, much stronger impact on women's capacity to seize economic opportunities and employers' prejudices against mothers. So for me, if we look at the evidence, if we see that gendered language countries like France can have pretty high gender equality, if we think about how people actually form their gender stereotypes, and if we think of the real world constraints to women in the world of work, I would say the government policy that is much more serious would be the two things, the policy on the school day, and also if the police are ineffective in responding to gender-based violence. Those would be far bigger priorities. Three, the lack of jobs, right? The lack of jobs should be a third major government policy. So I'm not telling Brazilian feminists what to do, but for me, based on the evidence I see, I would see the three biggest concerns would be the lack of jobs, the police disregarding gender-based violence, and the school day.
Yeah, the lack of jobs is something that, when I read about it on your blog, it was something that was like pretty clear. Like once you read it, it's just like, okay, it makes a lot of sense. Because if you just sell the idea that, okay, women are competent, they are capable, to people that have never been in contact with them working on a daily basis, they tend not to believe it. You know, they tend, like, once you social, even for racism or sexism, yes. I think once you get in contact, you socialize with people that you're not used to, all the prejudices, they tend not to connect, you know? So then it just falls apart. So it's, I think maybe like activism is very important, propaganda is very important, but if there's no connection to reality, I think it's not like, it's not going to bring a lot of changes. Isn't that the case of
absolutely.
Economic development?
Let me make 2 points on that. So absolutely, okay. There's so much research. So this goes back to contact theory. The idea is when people work together on shared projects, they come to recognize others' socially valued competencies, and then that weakens their gender stereotypes. And we see this in the world of work, and we also see this in families. So the people that we're closely observing are our parents or our children. So across countries, in Mexico, in France, in Switzerland, in the USA, lots of researchers have found that sons of women who have jobs are much more likely to marry women who have jobs and endorse gender equality. Because these guys have seen their mothers doing it. They've seen their mothers bringing home the bacon. They've seen their mothers in positions of authority. They've seen their mothers doing important stuff. And so they realize women can do it. And also, really importantly, sons of women who work, they learn to be a bit more independent because they don't have a mother waiting for them hand on foot, right? They don't have a woman who's there to cook their meals every day. So these guys grow up learning maybe how to cook their own dinner, how to make themselves a cup of coffee. So they're less likely to expect female subservience. These guys are independent. They've grown up like that. So they don't necessarily seek that out in a wife. Where systematically in Mexico and elsewhere, sons of housewives, one, they've seen their fathers being waited on by their mothers. Two, they themselves have been waited on and they want that too. It's a nice life, huh? And so that reference feeds into the generations. And also very interestingly, in America, there's nice research showing that fathers of daughters interrupted Janet Yellen less in her congressional hearing. And my hypothesis would be that if you're a father and you have a daughter and you see maybe her experiences of sexism and you want the best for your daughter, you know, you love and care about your daughter and you want her to do well, then these fathers may become more sensitive to barriers and obstacles against women and become more empathetic. So when we talk about what, you know, how female employment shapes our gender stereotypes, is very much, as you say, through firsthand interactions, not just through recognizing women's skills, but also having that empathy, that care and that love and that appreciation. Absolutely.
There's a strong connection between gender equality and economic development, right?
Yes.
So once economic development is not on the horizon, does that actually brings down any hope for higher gender equality?
Okay, so let me add 2 points. So firstly, okay, I would say it's not necessarily economic development per se, but the very specific kind, which is job creating. So you could have very high productivity that's clustered in a few sectors that doesn't create any jobs. So it could be hydrocarbons or oil or something like that. So what's really important is the jobs, because that enables women to go out to their homes to build these reverse dominance coalitions. That said, Latin America, so I definitely see the lack of jobs as an obstacle, because it makes it much, much harder for women to have economic independence, for women to gain all these coalitions. But still, even though Latin America's economic progress has been stalled, it still made massive headway on gender equality thanks to feminist rallies. Thanks to feminist rallies and also through media. Films, TV, social media, TikTok is much more gender equal than it used to be 20 years ago. So, you know, the telenovelas 20, 30 years ago, it was all about a poor woman, the Cinderella story of, oh, you know, this poor woman loves this rich guy and she can make it if she just, you know, she overcomes all these obstacles, and 230 episodes later, it's happily ever after and she's saved by a rich man. So those stories aren't so common, right, anymore. It's no less so about the woman being saved by marrying a rich guy. You know, there are many more diverse storylines. And that culture is important, like what you were saying earlier, the ideological persuasion. So yes, lack of economic development is a barrier, but cultural change is still possible, especially in Latin America, as long as you preserve democracy with feminist activism, free speech, and living in cities, yeah.
Okay. I think we're heading to the last questions here.
Okay. And, but you know me, I could take an hour to answer it.
I know. And it's I would like to have your thoughts on, recently, Yes. There has been a paper published recently, which is called The Myth of Man the Hunter. Women's contribution to the hunt across ethnographic contexts, right? Have you read it, and do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, right. Okay, so this is a paper, and the way the media often reported it was saying, hey, women can be hunters too.
Yeah, it's the same happened here in Brazil. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah, so it's true, but beneath the headline, there are a few more complexities. So women might hunt, but hunt small things. And that's because, you know, they might be, you know, before the modern era, women were spending 60% of their prime adult years either pregnant or nursing. So, you know, when you can't control your fertility, you've got a bunch of kids. And so it's a very, very risky situation for a woman with all those children to just go off on the hunt for a couple of nights into the bush, right? That would be a very, very risky strategy. So across cultures, we very, very rarely see women going off into the bush for nights on end to be tracking a big deer. That very rarely happens. So it might be something smaller, like building a small trap for a small prey, like a rodent or something like that. So, for example, I spent 18 months living in Zambia, including in rural areas in the bush, where men engaged in illegal poaching. Never once did women go off on illegal poaching. You know, that's a very dangerous thing with, you know, an overnight trip. Women would never do that. But the kids, the, like, young kids would teach me how to trap a rat. So if you need me to trap a rat, I'm there. I've got all the rat trapping skills you need. So one is the small animals. And secondly, there are a couple of methodological issues in that paper. So sometimes, you know, they classify a society, if it has female hunting, as like either one or zero. So even if women, you know, only hunt like one day in a year, like on Christmas Day or whatever, Christmas Day hunt, then it would still be categorized as having hunting. So don't worry about that.
Okay.
But people sometimes like these. So this goes back to our earlier discussion about confirmation bias. Like people who are very feminist and want to believe that a more gender equal world is possible might cling to these stories because it's like, oh, you know, patriarchy is just an invention. Actually, in hunter-gatherer communities, women are hunters. Hell yeah, that sounds great. You know, that's super empowering and emboldening, just as Barbie Land might be emboldening. And, you know, while we might like those stories of powerful, strong, tough women, you know, it's a bit of a fabrication. Now, you know, and going back to the point about being open about evidence, you know, I think we can just engage with all that evidence without being so ideologically consumed, right? So what if men were hunters? Like, that doesn't mean that men are naturally superior. That doesn't mean that our society has to have male leaders. Like, it's fine. Fine, most societies have men, hunters, whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any process, normative implications.
Yes, that's true. Completely true. But it gets a lot of attention online. It's like clickbaiting. I think it's a bunch of factors, right? And the more extreme sides of the political spectrum, they kind of like, they take over the public sphere of social media with these things, and it gets into a war. But it's hard to like just to clear have a clear idea what's going on, what's really true, what
it's
is
a nice
not.
Story.
You have to read the article itself.
For feminists, it may be a nice story, but you know, we don't have to rely on stories to learn about cultural diversity. Like when I was saying earlier about the Mongols, there really were women who hunted on horses and who were celebrated as warriors. So some of these stories are actually true. One just needs to look at the evidence and work out which ones.
So in the process of writing like, this big book, right? And I would like to know from you, like, do you see any other good books, like big history books that you like or that you think were interesting or you think they were important or they have influenced you? Or recently we had one from David Graeber and David Wengrow on The Dawn of Everything. But do you have any thoughts on that? Or do you have other books that you think were important to and actually helped you on your journey to write your
own? So many books. I love a lot. Okay, some of my favorite books.
So, for example, a couple of my favorite books this year. Let me think of the book that I think is most relevant to a Brazilian audience. I really liked Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson's new book, Power and Progress. Both, it has a very nice discussion of... It's all about technology. And it's about how elites may monopolize the profits from technology and also use the technology to favor their narrow interests. And even though technology may be seen as, wow, that's super fantastic, that's super innovative, it may not actually produce jobs. It may not actually improve productivity. There are lots of technologies associated with disinformation, with hate speech, with filter bubbles. And so they argue that we need to rethink our vision of society and so that we push technology to actually promote more jobs and to combat all that hate speech on the internet. So, for example, you know, I believe that for progress on gender equality, it's very, very important to have more jobs. And technology could actually help that. Because if you had technology that made workers more productive, that increased workers' marginal productivity, then companies would hire more workers because we'd, you know, for example, technology could help a nurse be more productive. You know, for example, a nurse may have difficulty lifting a man from a bed, for example, a heavy man. But if you had a technology that would enable her to lift him up to help him, that would be fantastic. You know, people need female carers, especially as our societies become older, and technology could assist with some of that caregiving. So there are lots of ways that technology could work for humans. And there are lots of ways in which our corporate algorithms might be redesigned to promote democracy. So, for example, Facebook was complicit in knowingly encouraging hate speech in the Rohingya genocide. And it allowed that and it tolerated that because it wanted to maintain its user base, right? So there are lots of ways in which they suggest we need to redirect technology so that it works for the benefit of humans. And because automation is now a very big thing, and you know, there's a real possibility that automation, if not change, could lead to the destruction of jobs. Right? Because, like, for example, in Brazil's manufacturing industry, if you have improved robots that can replace low-skilled labor, then we could be looking at massive job loss. You know, in the car industry, for example, if many of those jobs are replaced by machines, then that could be a serious, serious crisis. So I think this will be, and the reason that this is important is not just for promoting female employment, but preventing angry men. Because if men, you know, in Brazil, lots of men gain their status, their esteem from being breadwinners through providing for their families. Now, if shifts in technology and automation mean that firms want to cut their cost by increasing automation and firing all those workers, then you will have a lot of angry, upset men. There's some nice research showing in Brazil that areas hit by the recession where men lost more jobs in Brazil's recession, they're actually more likely to vote for Bolsonaro. So when men lose their jobs, they can sometimes be angry, they can sometimes lash out. I mean, it's not good for society generally. On all the indicators, it's pretty toxic. And that holds across Europe, across America, across Brazil. So that's something that I take very, very seriously as a major challenge. So their book, Power and Progress, I recommend it's something that we really need to think about.
Nice. And The Dawn of Everything, have you read the book?
Oh, yes.
Any thoughts on that?
So The Dawn of Everything is interesting. They have a little section on gender, actually, which I don't believe is correct. They suggest... They suggest that in hunter-gatherer societies, women had more autonomy. They even talk about the Zambian case, the Bembaland, which is a place I live and I speak Bemba, so it's not correct. But anyway, you know.
Okay. Good. And one last question before we talk about just a little bit about the book, and which is about the book. What is the importance of ethnographic work for you in the research that you do?
Okay, so that's so great. So my strategy in trying to understand the world, which is a crazy task, is twofold. One, I try to read as much as I can across many different disciplines. So anthropology, archaeology, economics, political science. But it also really helps me to talk to people, to listen to their stories. So like I was telling you in Mexico, where people were saying to me, people really used to care about gossip, but now they don't do anymore. So listening to those life histories is really important because it helps me learn what matters to people and how their lives have actually been changed. And what I really try to do when I'm listening to people is not to go in with my preconceived ideas of what I think is important, because the whole point is I'm ignorant. I don't know about life in Mexico. You know, I'm not Mexican. I haven't lived in Mexico. So I go in and I just chat to people and they just tell me about their lives. And it's by understanding their perspective and their priorities that really helps me get a better understanding of cultural change in Mexico. So I rarely ask questions. I rarely say, well, tell me about this or that, because that would be to presuppose I know what's important, and I don't. So actually, one thing I would really like, if any of your listeners want to reach out to me to chat, I would love it if they contact me. I would be over the moon if Brazilians contact me and want to have a chat. It would be totally anonymous. It would be totally confidential. I would love it. Please contact me. That would be fantastic. Whether it's me coming in person or into Brazil or just as a Zoom or WhatsApp chat, please contact me because I need to learn about Brazil. I need to understand all these things that are happening. So that's what I've been doing all over the world. So ever since 2009, I've been traveling to different places. I usually travel for at least 3 months a year. I lived in the Gambia for over 9 months, Zambia for over 18 months, then Cambodia, then Vietnam. Last year, I was in Morocco for a month. I was in India for 2 months, in Turkey for a month, in Italy. This year, I was in Spain. So I really, really try to spend a lot of time in different communities understanding what matters to people. So that's very, very important to me. So I may be the only person in the world who has done research in 6 continents. And now I have a new technology. So this is a good technology. Microsoft Translator provides this automatic voice translation. So it's a free app. And you can phone the person on Microsoft Translator and it's instant translation. So they speak in Portuguese, I speak in English, and it shows the text for both of us. And I was going around to little Mexican markets, chatting to guys, like selling things. And yeah, it was fantastic. So it's the new technology, this is one good technology, that really enables me to do research in 6 continents, which is very groovy.
Nice. And when is the book coming out? And are we going to have a
Portuguese translation? Version? Yes. Definitely. I would definitely want a Portuguese translation. It will take me another 4 years to write the book because I still need to learn the history of every single country in the world.
Okay.
Right? So I want to make it as good as possible. So this goes back to our earlier point that I'm not arrogant enough to think I know the answer already. This is my Goldilocks level of confidence. I don't think I know it. You know, so even if I can talk about these big themes, I still want to know countries better. I'm not so arrogant. So I need a little bit time to get it perfect. You know, that's okay. My female insecurity, neuroticism, anxiety coming up. But hopefully that will make the book that much better.
Nice. And if you ever come to Brazil, let me know. We'll get a studio and record like
I would love that. I would love that.
Okay, Alice, I think that's I've got everything covered, I believe. There would be way more questions, but I think I'll be doing the work of translation for this one. So
yes, you have a lot of work.
But thank you again. It was a pleasure. I'm a big fan of your work and I hope to have you again, maybe in person in a studio in the future.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Obrigado por ouvir esse episódio até o final. Se você gosta do nosso trabalho, não deixe de contribuir financeiramente com ele através do nosso Apoia-se. Você encontra o link na descrição do episódio. Tornando-se apoiador, você saberá de antemão quem são os nossos próximos entrevistados e poderá enviar suas perguntas, além de poder sugerir temas e pessoas para entrevistarmos.